I was told at one point I had to back off on my punishment.
Personally, I think they're the toughest of the three sports I've worked in.
You know, if that race had been 2 days longer, I tell you, we would have lost the tour.
You do sit there thinking, crikey, medically, 6 months of planning, and it's all down now to 1K and 1 minute.
One of the big things of the Tour de France, and nobody ever can see this until they've ridden it, it's so intense.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
This podcast was recorded at the Rafa Cycle Club in Manchester at an event hosted by me, Richard Moore, of the Cycling Podcast, in conversation with Rod Ellingworth, Performance Manager at Team Sky, and Dr. Richard Usher, Team Sky's Head of Medical Practice. We were in the upstairs exhibition space at the opening to an exhibition of photographs from this year's Tour de France, some taken by professional photographers, some submitted on social media under the hashtag Courage Cycliste. The exhibition Tour de Courage will run until mid-September and is well worth a visit. In the conversation you're about to hear, along with audience questions at the end, Rod Ellingworth and Dr. Usher give us a unique insight into this year's tour, what it was like on the inside, and also to be part of the winning team.
Thank you very much. Hello, everybody. My name is Richard Moore. This is Rod Ellingworth and Richard Usher. You might think my microphone's not on. It is on, but there's no amplification. This is just purely for recording purposes, so... So, Rod, I think your title's race coach, isn't it?
Oh, I've had several titles, I think, over the last 6 years, but official title now is performance manager of the team, so...
And Richard, you're the head doctor, not the doctor of the head, the head of the medical side of things. Obviously, it's a fantastic opportunity we have here to get a real insight into what it was like at the Tour de France this year and to be part of the winning team. Both obviously absolutely instrumental in that. Rod, I think this was your sixth tour. Richard, this was your first Tour de France. You've been with the team since the end of 2011. Tell us, you know, what were your impressions? How was the tour? How did it compare to other races?
It was my second actually grand tour. I did the Welter the year before, but I have to be honest, I sort of went into the process of building up to the tour with a lot of trepidation and sort of anxiety, really, about the level that we needed to work at. And I knew from previous tours the problems and the level of commitment that we needed. But I have to say, and I'm sure Rod will reiterate it, that it turned out for me to be the best tour and the best race I've done with Sky. I can't say there wasn't pressure or intensity there. There was, it fluctuated. A lot of preparation, which we can perhaps talk about later, in all departments. But actually getting on with the race and doing our jobs, it, in some ways it just seemed like another race in that respect.
Tell me, before we move on to Rod, what's a typical day? Is there a typical day? But what does it look like for you as a doctor?
Oh, crikey. If they're all well... which obviously we hope they are, but that's not always the case. Probably getting up about 6:30, planning the day, and then we do I won't call it a mini surgery, but the riders are offered the opportunity to come in and to see me in my room or an appointed room where we check on really how they slept, how they are. We do this well-being, check on them, we weigh them, or they weigh themselves. We check their hydration, and it's just a good opportunity after they've had a night's sleep to catch up, ready for the day. And then obviously they go down to breakfast. So for me, it's quickly packing up, getting out onto the bus, preparing then with the carers on the bus, some of the supplements perhaps, or hydration, depending on the weather and where we are. Following them in the race car, which is 5 hours, 4 or 5 hours in the car. Again, hoping there's no accidents or there's nothing traumatic from there. Coming back, we do another sort of quick check round them while they're having massage and catch up with them all, see how they are after the race, and then probably quickly just see them at bedtime to make sure they're okay.
You work almost as hard as a journalist on the Tour de France. It's quite an eye-opener. And I was going to just move on to Rod. So Rod, this is your sixth tour, so you've got a 50% success rate at the Tour de France. You've won three.
Apparently so, yeah.
I think the seeds of the success this year were sown during last year's tour, weren't they? Which was a very disappointing race from a Team Sky point of view. Obviously, Chris Froome crashed out in the opening week. Your plan B, Richie Porte, didn't quite deliver. And there was, I think, a lot of soul-searching, a lot of examining what had gone wrong, what needed to go right for next year. And I know that you and Dave Brailsford, and I think Tim Kerrison, took a drive together up to Paris on the final day and really discussed how you were going to approach this year's race. Is that pretty much what happened?
Yeah, I mean, we had a bit of a shocker last year, right from the start of the season. And I think once Chris Froome and Richie Porte, who were quite key to our success of the team. Both of them had problems early season with crashes and injuries and things like that. So right from the start of the season, it just knocked on and knocked on. And when you lose your two big players, it means the other players in the team, they have to do a lot more work, which means that they get more fatigued and so on. So I think we knew going into the tour, we were trying to sort of paint quite a rosy picture in a way, and hopefully, you never know with people like Chris. I think we've seen how hard he can fight, and he really is a fighter, you know. But it wasn't to be, you know, he crashed out as we saw last year. So right from there, we were pretty determined, you know, let's roll the sleeves up and find out what's gone wrong and look at how we can improve for this year. I think we'd sort of gone through this whole cycle of trying to be the best, winning it in 2012, and then you don't back off. But I think in a way what we did, we tried to get into other parts of the team to improve other parts of that area. For me as a coach sort of thing, I was given the role of to try and improve all the staff in the team from a race perspective and bring them up to speed quicker with new people. And I took my mind or my focus off the riders a lot. And I believe that was one of my failures of 2014. You know, and we decided in that car on the way up to Paris that I was going to go back to what I was doing, which was coaching, which was looking at performance and performance only, and leave the rest and give that to somebody else. So it was decisions like that, which I think certainly for me made a big difference. It felt like a lot of weight off my shoulders. So from July of last year, my whole focus was just on the bike riders and trying to win the Tour de France, basically. Yeah.
The team this year had a real British core, and more than that, a real sort of Rod Ellingworth core, because a lot of these guys are riders that you've coached for a long time. They're graduates of the British Cycling Academy, which I think started and ended 2005?
Beginning of 2004, yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
2004. Goodness, that was earlier than I thought. But you had Mark Cavendish, Geraint Thomas, you know, Ian Stannard's come through that, Pete Kennick's come through that, Luke Rowe came through it just a bit after your time. But, you know, how did that feel for you as a coach to have these guys at the biggest bike race in the world and for so many of them to have been guys that you've really nurtured for so long?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, like anything, I think it doesn't feel like a job because you get so involved in these lads' lives. And like I said, I've known some of them since they were sort of, well, I've been working with Ian Stannard since he was 14, you know, like properly working with him a lot and nearly every day. So you see them, and in a way you are a bit of a father figure to them as well, you know, and you take a lot of responsibility for them. So yeah, I was really proud to see them all achieve what they want to do, you know. And I mean, you know, it wasn't just our team. Obviously there was people like Alex Dowsett as well who didn't end up finishing, but you know, just to see people like Alex as well coming through, it was just fantastic. Yeah.
I mean, anyone who's, I'm sure you've all read Rod's book. If you haven't, I highly recommend it, Project Rainbow, the story of how Mark Cavendish won the world title in 2011. And also in Mark Cavendish's own book, there's all these stories about what a disciplinarian you were, you know, sending them out for night, you know, 4 hours, 4 hours at night, you know, all kinds of really terrible punishments. It's almost hard to believe that you're capable of this. But how, presumably, that your management, your coaching style with these guys has had to change over the years. How has it changed? How have you managed that transition?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when these lads joined me as young kids, really, and certainly at that, when they first come to live here in Manchester and they were 18, you know, we deliberately put them in the middle of the university area of Manchester. I gave them enough rope that they could go out and do what young lads want to go do of an evening, but I made sure that, you know, they had to be at the velodrome at 7:30 every morning without fail. And there's, yeah, quite a lot of stories. I think I was told at one point I had to back off on my punishment because some people said it was getting a bit over the top. But, you know, I mean, I know the lads now, they talk to me and say it was the time where they really found themselves, and I think they knew that they had plenty of support. And I think we still run, we run Team Sky in very much the same way, that we're very rider focused. We expect a hell of a lot of everybody, certainly the riders on our team, but we do also have, we do put our arm around them every now and again and support them and give them the best that we can, you know. But I mean, over the time, yeah, my relationship had to change because I had to go from this being on top of them all the time and not giving them one millimetre to sort of letting them grow up and be adults. At times, I can't say it was easy. I'm sure you've heard of Steve Peters and a lot of the work that Steve has done. And I spent a whole year going to Steve every week. And it was part of the, I wanted to learn about how to work with these young men who were, you know, all of a sudden becoming, you know, adults and got their own free mind. And I found it really, really interesting, you know. And now, you know, seeing some of these guys, they're married now, they've got kids, they're growing up, you know, so it's great experience, really. Yeah,
some great stories that you probably didn't even realize at the time in Cav's book in particular, about, you know, that you had a ban on girlfriends visiting at certain times, and he He allegedly. I read it in a book, so it must be true. His then girlfriend Melissa had to hide in a cupboard when you popped round, and when you saw the Formula One Grand Prix on the TV, you decided you'd stay and watch it. And three hours later, she's still in the cupboard under his head. Anyway, it's obviously not true. We've set the record straight on that one. Just before we're going back to you, Dr. Usher, one more question for you, Rod, on this particular subject, because courage is the theme of the RAFA campaign, and I've heard this story before. Working with these young guys, Geraint Thomas was obviously a revelation of the tour this year. You've presumably always seen his potential, his talent. There's a great story that you told me once about a race in the Alps when he came off his bike and injured himself quite badly, came down for breakfast the next day dressed in his tracksuit rather than his race kit. Can you remember that story?
Yeah, it's funny because we talked a lot about that this year, because I think we went over the Col de Glandon three times in this year's tour. And it was I think it was 2005, I can't remember what race it was, but it was an under 23 race in France. And the last stage was finishing on top of the Col de Glandon. So it was we were going back over a few memories there. And it was the first time that Geraint, Ed Clancy, Mark Cavendish, and these sort of guys had ever raced in the Alps. And it was the first time they'd proper sort of experienced major climb. So yeah, the day before we'd done a team time trial, and they were going all well. I think they were like 40 seconds up overall. We only had 5k to go, and for some reason Mark Cavendish decided to swing left rather than swing right off the front and just wipe the rest of them out behind. And poor old Geraint, he always does seem to come off quite bad. He sort of went down. It was a red hot day. The tarmac was roasting hot, and he just went full face first, hands down. And he literally did take off the main part of his palm on both sides, the skin off the palm of his hands. So we patched him up. Back then we didn't have the luxury of having the doctors with us and everything. So I did my best, cleaned him up, patched him up, and then so the next morning we're doing the team meeting in the hotel, and Geraint comes down in his tracksuit, and we do the team meeting, and I was thinking, why is he in his tracksuit? You know. Anyway, I says, come on then, lads, right, let's get out there. And Geraint's looking at me still. And I said, what's up with you, Geraint? And he says, oh, no, there's nowhere I can start. And I'm like, well, you don't pedal with your hands. So poor Geraint, yeah, this does show the courage of Geraint. And to be totally fair to him, you know, he wasn't in a fit state to race, really. But he got his kit on and he started and he did finish. He was about an hour down in the end. And I kept dropping back and I was with him all the way up the Glandon. But, you know, I think it's little things like that where a lot of people would have said, or wrap them up in a lot of cotton wool and let them sort of just get away with it in a way. But, you know, whether I was right or wrong, I don't know. But they talk about it as moments of real getting them through life and them understanding how hard this sport is, actually, yeah.
Well, it's a good moment to pass back to Dr. Usher, because Geraint, obviously, in 2013, finished the tour with a broken bone in his pelvis. So he epitomises that courage, I suppose. Your job is almost sometimes, I guess, to protect them from themselves. Is that a fair comment? I mean, riders are very reluctant, as we've seen, to give up. We had Fabian Cancellara finish a stage this year with broken bones in his back. How difficult is that sometimes to get the balance right between the rider's desire to carry on and, you know, his health?
I think that's a very good question. I think the riders, certainly the ones that I've been exposed to, they really do epitomise the courage that you're saying about tonight from the tour. It's sometimes my job, you're right, to try and get them off the bike rather than their desire to want to get back on. At the end of the day, we just have to, you know, work out what is the best for them. There are times, particularly with head injuries and issues like that, particularly talking about Geraint and the tour this year and potentials from when he crashed. But no, I generally find with them that they are a really tough breed. I was amazed when I first started doing cycling from rugby as to how they were back on the bike before I'd even got there, with injuries and skin loss that for most people you would, you know, feel they'd be off the bike. But they're sensible, they're mature, and once you get to know them and you can talk to them in rational situations, that they will listen to advice generally. The difficult scenario medically for us is, of course, we're not always there when they do crash and they get back on the bike. And some of the races I spend time pondering and wondering and wishing I could know what's going on. And you don't till the end of the race. And that's some of the difficulties. You know, with rugby and other sports, you can actually pull athletes off and you can assess them. But with riders, of course, you don't get that luxury. So that is a difficulty.
Well, you mentioned other sports. You work in football, you've worked in rugby. How do cyclists compare to those other sports people?
Personally, I think they're the toughest of the three sports I've worked in. They're all different in their, obviously, their physical attributes, the endurance, the physical, and then perhaps the speed and the endurance. So it's been interesting working between the three sports. And I think for me, it has been a real learning curve looking at the training and the coaching and perhaps the nutrition, which for cycling is really geared to training, to racing, far more so than any other sport that I've worked in.
As a doctor, it must be constantly varied and changing challenges that you face. Is it stimulating? Is it enjoyable? You can go from bandaging people up after a crash to, you know, monitoring their health, checking for infections, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a dream job in many respects. And I went into this tour feeling very honoured and what a fantastic position I was in. And I had to just keep remembering that. And although if your day's quiet, actually for me, that's probably a good thing. So if there aren't issues, if there aren't health issues, if there aren't crashes, okay, I'm quiet.
But what about another aspect of cycling? You know, you've worked in team sports, rugby and football, which are obvious team sports. Cycling is less obviously a team sport, but obviously it is a team sport. For you coming into the sport, was it an eye-opener to realise that kind of structure to it, and that there are riders at the tour, part of the team, whose only job is to help somebody else, a team leader?
Yes, I a huge learning curve, perhaps for the first year, 18 months. I struggled quite to understand a system where you could have 40-odd races or 50 races in the year, and maybe the same eight might never race together in that calendar year. And I don't think in the tour, I don't think all nine or had raced together at all this year, had they, as a group. So I found it quite hard to understand the individual coming into a team sport, and then also understanding those individual roles, the domestiques, and understanding the psychology of that. It's a huge change.
I was going to ask you about psychology, because Rod mentioned Steve Peters, who's a psychiatrist.
I'm glad he's seen him, by the way.
And he's obviously worked very closely with the team. As far as I know, there wasn't a psychologist on the race this year with the team or anybody. So is that part of your remit as well?
I think for all the performance staff and all the staff, the carers as well, they probably listen more to the riders on the massage table. They pick up some of their social, their worries, their anxieties, and they probably put in as much into, or if not more, the time than any of us do into helping listen. I'm not sure they'd give advice, but I think everybody in the team, in other words, has some aspect to that in a pastoral way. And riders will pick different things up off different ones of us. There might be some riders that I do know well at home with their families, because I've seen and met the families. They'll ask about that. There might be others that know Rod better from the younger ages and will go to him. So yeah, I think we have to offer, and we do offer, great pastoral and support. And then Steve Peters is always there as a resource for us, a phone call away, and he's fantastic if we need it.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
Rod, you mentioned that, you know, it worked, you won the tour. So obviously something went right. It clicked this year. Can you put your finger on why? I mean, what went right this year?
Well, you know, I think to win the tour, it's such a big thing in a way. It's every single day you've got to take every meter of the road. You know, you just never know what's going to happen. But I think just to go back, I think one of the key aspects of this year's tour was the way in which the staff worked. And I think just going back to that whole thing, part of our objection and goal really since the end of last year's tour was to make sure that the staff were working the best that they could, so that they could all support each other. So we don't have, you know, for instance, from my point of view, I don't want to have to manage staff on a race. I don't want to have to deal with their problems. We just want to give 100% to the bike riders. So I think, again, you know, they're success stories in itself, you know, and I think we all do our bit, and none of us are stepping over the lines. We all know, you know, don't do something that you don't know about. Don't talk to somebody that you know, if somebody asks you a question and you really don't know, or you don't know the answer, say I don't know what it is. And I find that a lot of people will not tell the truth really to somebody and just I think pass it on to somebody. So if somebody comes to me on a medical thing, it's go see the doctor, you know, don't talk to me about that sort of issue. So I think as a team we worked super well together.
And Geraint, it was a real breakthrough for him in a way, you know, a few days away from challenging for the podium. He had those couple of bad days towards the end, but was that a surprise to you to see how he performed, and what does it mean for his future?
It wasn't a surprise because I think Gawain has been targeting the Grand Tours for a couple of years now. I think it's, you know, some of them get there a little bit quicker than others, but he stated a couple of years ago he wants to win a Grand Tour. I think we saw in the Tour Switzerland, you know, second overall, and the way he performed there in the mountains was bang on the money really there. So I think we didn't expect him to last so long in this year's tour. You know, the objective always was Chris. It was never with Geraint. And I think, you know, a lot of people started talking about maybe Geraint can make the podium. And to be fair to Geraint, you know, I think deep down, yes, he would love to make the podium, but he was the first one to give up his opportunity there, you know. And I think on that morning of the stage where Geraint came off the GC, we were doing quite a lot of turbo warm-ups in the morning because it was quite a hard start. And I just happened to sort of glance at Geraint and I looked at him and he looked at me and I knew straight away, and he knew straight away. He just sort of, his eyes went up in the back of his head and he was just like, I haven't got it today. But you know, with Geraint, he'll always try his best. And he said to me afterwards, the moment he got on the bike, he thought, I can't stay with Chris. So what I'm going to do is just sit up and completely come off GC. Because I think if he'd have carried on riding at his own tempo and limited his losses, he could have finished top 10 on GC himself. But he knew we had another two real key stages in the Tour de France. And Geraint being a true teammate, he thought, no, I'm going to give all that up. You know, when we talk about riders' salaries and we're negotiating new contracts with riders, if they finished in the top 10 of the Tour de France, their salaries go up massively. You know, it's a huge increase in salary. So this guy gave up that opportunity to make sure Chris won. So, you know, I think that's a true sign of a real teammate, you know.
We've obviously been aware of Geraint for years and a huge talent, double Olympic gold medalist. And I guess that's it's a great sort of testament to what a teammate he is. But does that also mean that he's perhaps not suited to be a leader? Because it strikes me, I mean, I've been asked about this a lot, about Geraint in particular. You know, does he have what it takes to be a champion, a winner in a race like the Tour? And my answer is always, he seems far too well adjusted for that. He seems like too nice a guy for that, too normal for that in a way.
Do you know, I mean, I've never come across anybody who is so headstrong as Geraint. He's physically very good, but mentally he's so strong. I mean, he's incredible how strong the guy is mentally. I think he has everything. I think he doesn't find it as easy as some, certainly weight control. You know, he has to work so hard on his weight, but he has everything else, you know. I think he's now, his belief, you know, he got to stage 19 of the Tour de France, and I think in fourth position. And I think if you get to, say, the end of the first week in fourth position and you come off GC, there's still doubt. You get to stage 19 and you're fourth on GC, I think it gives everybody a lot of belief. And one of the key things from us as a team is, as I said, you know, we are very rider focused. We believe in following the lads' dreams. You know, and if a young person says, this is what I want to do, you know, and you can see they have a talent, you've got to follow their dreams. And I think, you know, that's what Geraint wants to do, and we're going to go for it, you know. And I don't think Chris Froome will be, you know, Tour de France champion every year. You know, things happen. And we've got Geraint Thomas in the wings. So I think we're super motivated by that, to be honest.
So I've got him completely wrong then. I'm going to have to eat my words.
Well, you never know, do you? But, you know, I think he's certainly shown there, hasn't he? He's got the potential, you know.
So Chris Froome then, what does Chris Froome have beyond clearly tremendous ability? I mean, he's an enigma to a lot of people, I think, because they see this very well-mannered, very polite guy, and we hear about what a fight, you're not smiling knowingly at that, we see what a fighter he is, we hear about how tough he is, how single-minded he is, how focused he is on the job, and we hear stories about him, you know, confronting Vincenzo Nibali in his own team bus. So, and we hear these stories, and they don't sort of tally with the Chris Froome that we think we know. What, back to my original question before I rambled, what does he have? What makes Chris Froome the champion that he is?
I've never known anybody who fights as much as Chris, you know, and I think we saw in Dauphiné.
Nibali can talk about that.
Yeah, Nibali can talk about his actual physical fighting. you know, in the Dauphiné, I don't know if you remember that Chris came off the GC and he was 2.5 minutes down. And that evening, Pete Kenner rang me and he just says, I mean, I can't repeat every word he said because he was so sort of up for it. And there was a lot of swearing came out. But he said, Froome got, as soon as the race was over, he came on the bus and he just said, lads, don't lose, basically, he sort of said, don't lose faith in me. I'm going to do it tomorrow. We're going to get this time back. Now, I think everybody, even myself, was like thinking, we're never going to win the Dauphiné. how can he win the Dauphiné? He's 2.5 minutes off, you know, and he just has so much fight in him that it's pretty impressive, really. But I think he's so single-minded as well, you know. He's hard to budge, isn't he? Really hard to budge. He's hard to sort of get him to believe in something different. He has this belief and he goes for it. And at times that catches him out. And I think in his early years, I mean, I've known Chris since 2007, and from there until about middle of 2011, his own beliefs just kept catching him out, you know. And but eventually he got it, you know, and he's once he pieced it all together, and a lot of it was about his life and his training and diet and just what it actually takes to be a Tour de France winner, you know. But he wrote to me in 2007. I asked him, I said, what do you want to be? What's your goals? What's your long-term ambition, short-term ambition? And his long-term ambition was to win the Tour de France. And that was in 2007. And what he wrote, it was pretty impressive. And how he was going to do it, and when he was going to get a podium, and so forth. And he's literally hit every single marker, you know. So he's got that belief inside him, you know.
There was, you know, obviously huge internal pressure when you're on a team trying to win the Tour de France, but there was a lot of external pressure this year, a lot of negativity around the team. How did that affect the team? Did that bring you all closer together, or did it? Did you see it affecting some members of the team, staff and riders, in a negative way?
I mean, I think we all went through different periods this year of... It was like a... It's quite disheartening a lot, you know. And I think somebody like myself who... You know, I love bike racing. I've been... You know, my family's bike riders. I've grown up with cycling. So you never... You know, watching the Tour de France as a kid, and in the 80s going off and watching the Kellogg's Criterium Series and things like that as a kid, and just being a fan of the sport, you would never believe this would happen in cycling. But I think from a team point of view, you know, it did bring us closer together. We had to really sort of have meetings and say, right, we know what we're doing. Let's not let this affect us. We've got to try and protect the lads first and foremost. In the Tour, I'm always about half an hour to 45 minutes ahead of the race, doing the recon of every part of the road, and I'm sending information back. So quite often I was the first car that anybody on the road was seeing, and we were getting quite a lot of abuse. And but it was in small pockets, to be honest. I would say 95% of the spectators out there were very much supporting what we did, but there was just these small pockets of people that seemed like the same type of people who was giving us stick. But, you know, fortunately, nothing happened. I don't know what the sport is going to do in the future to give extra security, you know. But it's quite frightening at times, wasn't it? You know, I mean, you was in the race car, you experienced quite a few different things, I'd say, Doc. But
no, I agree with Rod. I think the way Dave and the way the management and pulled us all together and just kept us focused on our own jobs and said, look, we'll deal with the outside. You just get on with your own jobs. I think in the car... I think there was probably only one or two days. I think Alpe d'Huez, there were certain times there where some of the wing mirrors were off, and it wasn't pleasant to be sitting there, and you had to make sure that your windows were closed, and you also had to check that the DS hadn't got his finger on your window just to get me wet. But
to be honest, that's quite normal on Alpe d'Huez. Yeah. I don't think it matters what car you're in, especially going through Dutch Corner. You get a lot of excited people who've been up there drinking for several days. Yeah. We'll throw it open to questions soon, but just a couple more questions. You had Luke Rowe this year on the team, another product of the British system. He's another one who's had a breakthrough year this year. How impressed were you with him, and how did he cope with the Tour?
I'll say it from my perspective, and Rod obviously can look from coaching, but Luke sort of started almost the same time that I did in the team, so I've actually sort of seen him mature, I think is the word I would say, and change from how he was and how he is now. There was a time in the Welter last year where Dave B recognised that Luke, and actually Rod as well, I think, Luke just needed a little bit more help in reassurance, in looking after himself, just a little bit more time into him than we might normally do. So we spent and we sort of pulled him out and identified him as a rider that was in need of that support and that extra reassurance medically and time-wise. And he really, for me, grew through that race. He really benefited from that and actually said at the end, thank you, I really appreciated that effort from everybody. I think everybody took a little bit of time with him. And certainly for me, looking after him personally, he's a model to look after. He's a pleasure. He's certainly matured. I'm saying from my point of view. But he's certainly much easier and better than he was when I first joined the team. There's always stories, as we all know.
Yeah, Rod, not always a pleasure. Would you like to elaborate on that?
No, he's a good lad, actually, Luke. I think working with Luke for a few years now, and like I say, he did grow. And I think one of the key things from last year as well too was just this daily monitoring. And this was the real key thing for him. So basically, you know, every day just looking at himself in the mirror when he got up in the morning and asking himself certain questions. And am I ready? Have I done this? Have I done mentally everything that I need to do? And I think he's very coachable. That's the issue with Luke. He's a real coachable person. And, you know, I think once somebody can open themselves up like that, you can move them massively from a coach's point of view. But, you know, going into this year's tour, he'd done everything he's done. He's one of the best bike riders in the world at getting himself around the peloton and being very smooth in his delivery on the bike. But one of the big things of the Tour de France, and nobody ever can see this until they've ridden it, it's so intense. It's not just, you know, there's not just the bike racing itself, but there's all the crowds. There's the crowds at the hotel. There's the crowds at the bus before and after the race. And every day this just builds up. And I sort of said to Luke beforehand, I said, Luke, this is going to be like riding sort of 15 Paris-Roubaix. You'll have some days where you're going to be out the back after the first mountain and you've just got to look after yourself through that day. But the other 15 days, it's going to be like riding 15 Paris-Roubaix. And he sort of laughed at me a little bit. And after the fourth or fifth day, I went round to see him in his room and he just looked at me and he was absolutely shattered by then already. He was on his knees. And he'd had a real shocker of a day on the day where we expected him to be really good, which was on the cobbles. He had the worst day of the whole tour for him. And he was near enough in tears and saying to me, you said this is 15 Paris-Roubaix. He's like, I don't think I can survive. And this was after the fourth or fifth day. And he was, you know, and then afterwards, when he's had a few beers on the Sunday night, he was just saying, you were exactly right, you know. So
you shattered the illusion of Team Sky as this very controlled.
Well, they had a good night, I can tell you. And well, Luke,
you're talking about at the end of the tour.
Oh, yeah.
You're not talking about mid race. I thought you were meaning mid race.
At the end of the race, he had a few beers. Yeah. So yeah. So Luke, he's you know, he's certainly got. He's going to have a great
allowed,
future.
Beers allowed.
In the race. Yeah. Maybe. No. Do you know, I tell you what,
the few beers, he sort of opened up and said, you know, that support he got helped.
Yeah, yeah. He just sort of said, you know, it really did help him focus on what he was actually trying to do every day. And he realised this is a huge thing. There's nothing else like it, you know. Like I say, you think Paris-Roubaix has got to be the biggest, most technical, everything else. And he was just like, it doesn't even touch the Tour de France, you know. I think this year's tour, though, talking to a lot of riders who have done several or even more tours, they all said this year's tour was the hardest they've ever done. So I think it was quite unique this year. The whole parkour, everything was unique.
What was the moment in the race where you realised that Froome was the best rider in the race?
I think it was on the Mur du Huy where he just looked so sort of in control. Yeah, I think that, for me, that was the moment, yeah. And I thought we could win this. And he obviously took the jersey on that day. Mm. And I mean, I remember in the evening, I went for a little walk with Dave and we were panicking a little bit, thinking, whoa, you know, we really don't want the jersey this early. And I think that added the pressure to everybody. I mean, I think the next day Tony Martin took it, I think. Mm. But then the next day Tony crashed, so we were back in it again. So, yeah, all them, you know, it's extra pressure. I mean, for Chris every day, once you're in the jersey, it's like, it's, you know, he's got the podium, he's got all the media, he's got dope control.
It's fascinating to hear Rod say that, because at the time, of course, you asked him, you know, are you happy to have the jersey at the moment? He's like, yeah, of course, yeah, we're delighted to have the jersey. Wouldn't be in any other position, but so it's slightly different.
But it just adds longer days,
yeah,
when you don't have to have it, you know. I think the real interesting thing from this year's tour was, well, Chris certainly didn't win the Tour de France in the mountains. If anything, you know, if that race had been 2 days longer, I tell you, we would have lost the tour. Chris's health was deteriorating, and as we had quite a few health issues through the tour with the riders, just from, you know, quite often normal sort of chest problems, but, you know, they'd worked so hard through the tour that they were deteriorating. But Chris actually won the tour on the flat stages in the first week, which was really interesting for us, you know.
Well, just I want to ask one final question before we open it up to the audience, and it's about that penultimate day to Alpe d'Huez, where, you know, it was a thrilling sort of twist for everybody watching, maybe not for you guys, but where were you when that stage was playing out, and what were your emotions? What were you thinking? Were you thinking, he's losing it here?
Well, yeah, I was, I was ahead of the race. I'd done my job ahead of the race, then got to the top of Alpe d'Huez. And I got out of the car because I couldn't find anybody else. And there was a big screen, and I was just basically with it, all the general public, with, watching it on the big screen. And I was shouting a fair bit. Yeah, I was shouting. But yeah, I thought he was losing it. I really did. I mean, and that was where, you know, Richie and Walt did an absolute fantastic job that day. And if he didn't have them two that day, I think we would have lost the tour, potentially, yeah.
And Richard, you had a ringside seat, did you? Were you in the lead car for this stage?
In second car,
right?
Yeah.
So were you able?
There
to...
is every day. I just because I think I was in the second car. I think Dave right. was in the first.
He was
car.
In the first car. So yeah. Were you aware of what was going on? And I mean, as a doctor, his health had been deteriorating since the second rest day. It was obvious to us in the press room when he came in for his press conference every day that he was very croaky. You could hear that he didn't sound very well. That must have been you must have had your hands full with that the final week.
Yeah, no, it's true. I think, like Rod, we could see what was going on. We actually had got a signal on the TV at that time. And we could, just as the kilometres were getting further and further down, we could see the time gap going, and we could hear 30 seconds, 45, 50, you know. And, yeah, it's, you know, for sure I was thinking... Crikey, in my head, there's only a kilometre to go. I'm sure he can make it now. But yes, it was a risk. Not a risk, it was a worry, because we knew that Chris's respiratory cold and chest was deteriorating as the last few days went on. And as Rod said, I think without Richie and Walt taking him up there, or another K, another two Ks on that final climb, I don't know how that would have gone. But yeah, you do sit there thinking, crikey, medically, 6 months of planning, performance-wise, 6 months of planning, and it's all down now to 1K and 1 minute, and you're sitting there on absolute edge.
I mean, how ill was he? Because Dave Brailsford in Paris said that in any other circumstances, he would have been on some kind of medication, but he's had the controversy before with the TV, and he was very reluctant to go down that road and certainly didn't want to go down that road. How ill was that, and what could you do to help him?
I think you're quite right. I mean, he certainly wasn't sick that he shouldn't ride, you know, from that point of view. And we always have to make those decisions with them, which are very hard. And with Chris, there's certain strategies that we've taken medical advice from around the UK and Europe on about how to try and maintain his respiratory function, if you like. So we just managed for the last 4 or 5 days, every day maintaining him and treating him, which for me was 3 or 4 times a day. And we had 2 or 3 others. Obviously, Pete withdrew, our Pete Kenner, after he'd been ill, had actually recovered really from a respiratory point of view, but then had a hell of a day when he missed the peloton, dropped out, didn't he, and did a lot of work. And so actually we got Pete better, and Richie wasn't so good. So yeah, it's on an edge. There are things you can do, and as you say, Chris was very adamant this time. He didn't want to go down any other route that we've done before.
This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Join us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast.
I'm sure lots of you have questions. I'll put a hand up, anybody who's got a question. There's one there.
On that last stage on the Alpe d'Huez, obviously Chris was suffering. You could tell that on the TV. Were you just relying on the two riders that were with him, or were you actually on the radio with him, sort of like coaching him through it?
Well, I think the noise on the mountain for the riders was a real issue. That apparently they couldn't hear a lot, but I could hear from my car what Nicholas Portell, the lead sport director, was telling him. And to be honest, Nico is a real calm guy, and that's one of the reasons why he's our lead sports director at the tour, is because he just delivers this message even when it was full panic mode. But he was really calm, and even though he's getting his car kicked at and things thrown at his car, he's still, you know, he's exceptional in that role. And I think Chris knew what he had to do. That was the thing. I think in Chris's head, He was panicking, but he knew he was still in control, and the race was still his at that moment. So I think it perhaps looked worse than it actually was, yeah.
How realistic do you think it is to win all 3 Grand Tours in a calendar year, no matter what the incentive might be?
Yeah, well, I think it's really hard, yeah. You've only got so many riders on your team, and there's only so many riders in the world who can win a Grand Tour. So it's not impossible, is it? For sure, it's not impossible. Yeah, you know, it can be done. You'd have to be right on the money with everything, and Right, the main thing is riders staying healthy, to be honest.
Crikey. I mean, Contador was off, was he'd won the Welsh of the Giro, hadn't he? And then this would have been three if he'd won this one. I mean, there's a certain amount of luck, I think, in it, and firstly in for these riders, you know, any crash, any one instant in any race prior to a Grand Tour, you know, they can break a collarbone, they can break a scaphoid, as we've seen. So there's a certain amount of luck that we all have to have. Maintaining a rider's health through three Grand Tours is a huge ask, to be honest. And themselves maintaining what they do in between as well. It's enough of an ask to try and get them through one Grand Tour. Because illness and health issues are much more of a risk to me from a medical point of view than the crashes in some ways, because our main problems are illness usually. You might have 3-4 crashes, but you might have 20 illness issues during the 3 weeks or so. So illness and unwellness is probably high on my list for these guys. And it's a very hard ask, I think, for three.
What was one of the punishments if they didn't turn up at the velodrome at 7:30?
Brilliant.
Are you ready? there was plenty. I mean, what I'm just trying to think. Put me on the spot. I mean, a simple one was if one of them messed up, it meant the whole team messed up. So I would email everybody in British Cycling and say, bring your car tomorrow. The lads are outside cleaning the car. So I didn't mind who saw them or what they were meant to be doing training-wise. The next day, they were cleaning cars for the whole day, you know. So
Rob,
that was one thing, yeah.
Far be it from me to prompt you on this, but did you not also have them riding around the top of the track just for hours on end?
Yeah, that was another one, yeah. I can't remember what that one was for. But we have every afternoon in British Cycling is a 2-5 track session. So one of their punishments, they weren't allowed to come off the track. I just stood right in the middle of the track with my arms folded, and they had to ride around the top of the track for 3 hours non-stop at a certain pace and no more than sort of like 20 mils apart. And if they did, I shouted at them at the top of my voice. And I got into trouble a fair bit there because the old track manager, I had them with bottles in the back pocket, and she didn't like that because, you know, if you dropped a bottle down the track. Because obviously the rest of the session, you know, all the sprinters, Chris Hoy and all them boys were banging around the bottom of the track, and these lads were...
There was some compassion there. He didn't want them to be dehydrated. So he has a heart after all. Any other questions?
This is just a question for each of you, actually, in your roles during the tour. Your personal highlights and lowlights during this year's?
Low for me was the... just seeing kids actually giving us a hard time on the side of the road. I thought that was quite sad, you know. And you could see it was egged on by their parents to give us a hard time. As in, you know, booing the riders and things like that, which I thought was quite sad. Highlight for me was seeing Steve Cummins winning the stage. By far the best point for me, yeah.
Crikey, I think I'd agree with Rod about the knowing the culture of the team and just seeing the reaction from the crowds, or the small amount of crowds, and just knowing how we work was really disappointing. Highlights, crikey. For me, from a medical point of view, I think it would be seeing Richie help pull Chris up on the final day, because Richie, I'd spent a lot of time and work with him as well. He'd been quite sick probably 4 or 5 days before, and I'd probably spent 4 or 5 times a day seeing him and getting him through, a lot of encouragement. He is a guy that can sometimes be knocked off quite easily if he feels not 100%. So for me, it was really, really satisfying and happy and pleasing to see him on that final day, just be there and be there for Chris, I think, and to pull him up and to keep him up there. From the team point of view, I think socially we had a great barbecue on our first rest day, which was good. It's something, again, from a team I haven't quite experienced, the willingness for us to get all the staff out by the back of the hotel, get a barbecue out, and just have a good evening as a team. That was really enjoyable.
You want me to answer that as well? My low light would also be the very small crowd trouble, because it becomes a sort of almost a self-fulfilling prophecy in a way. As soon as somebody does it, other people get encouraging. You hope that the overwhelming majority of fans will keep those small elements in check. I hope that's how it works, and that next year, you know, if somebody does, you know, touches a rider, punches a rider, that the other fans sort of try and do their bit to make sure that they know that's unacceptable. As an impartial, well, I mean, with, you know, I'm not advocating any kind of violence or anything like that, but as an impartial, objective journalist, I did enjoy Quintana on Arc Duez, and you know, just the twist, because I think at the end of the Pyrenees, it felt like the race was done. You know, it felt like the race had been won, and nobody really wants that. Even, you know, for Froome to win in the way that he did, probably he emerges with even more credit than had he just kept that huge advantage that he had. So Quintana's a very exciting rider to watch, you know, and I think people were urging him to really let rip, as it were. And he didn't seem to do that in the Pyrenees, but he seems to get stronger as the race goes on, or less weak. And, you know, that it was very similar to 2013, and it sets things up, I think, very nicely for next year, with the balance sort of tilting maybe back to Quintana, especially if the, mind you, the course is probably going to suit Froome more than Quintana next year. I don't know.
If you could sign any rider, who would it be who would complement Sky, the Sky roster?
Great question.
I think there's some really good talent out there. I quite like Barguil. I think he would be a good addition to our team. You know, I think Dave said it, was it last year or the year before, to take on a French rider and to try and win the Tour de France with a French rider. Personally, I think that would be... we wouldn't get any more abuse from the French. But my role before this was working with the under-23 national team, and there's so many good French under-23 riders, and they always win at that under-23 level. But they tend to go on to stay on the French teams, they pay them big money, and they never really move on. And I think, you know, he's one guy who hasn't stayed on a typical French team, so he's showing that sort of willingness. He needs to learn how to break going into corners, mind. But, you know, I think, yeah, he'd be somebody for me I'd be really interesting to work with, yeah.
You heard it here first.
I'm always amazed at the speed the pros go up the hill, but I'm equally amazed at the speed they go down and how fearless they are. So the topic is courage tonight. Yeah. Is that something that's innate in a rider, or do you have to coach that? So a 14-year-old boy to a 21-year-old man all of a sudden is going down 90K, down a climb. How do you get that sense of courage in that situation with a rider?
I think if you take up a sport late, the chance of you making it in that sport is quite small. Certainly in male cycling, endurance cycling, I'd say it's really small. And that's one of the reasons is, you know, I think we all know as we get older, you do slow down and you start thinking about the risks. Working with these guys and knowing them from real young kids, when we first started, you know, I went to live in Italy with them guys, Geraint and Cavs and all these lads. And I used to have to put the car in front of them and tell them they're not allowed to go past me, because just on some days I just couldn't hack it. You know, I was out there on my own with them, and Ian Stannard's the worst in the world for it. They'd be banging down these descents, you know, and I was like, Ian, I don't want to have to ring your mum and dad and say, I'm ever sorry, your son's in hospital, you know. It is just something in them. They're like, they love the thrill of it, to be honest. Geraint Thomas is slightly the other way. He, you know, I think we all know Geraint, you know, I think he's unlucky quite often with his falls. I really do. You know, it's like the crash in the Tour, you know, he was just in the wrong place at the wrong time there, or in the right place for Warren, that's for sure. You know, Geraint's really got a fear at the moment of crashing, and I know the morning of the stage he crashed in Paris-Nice, you could have guaranteed Geraint was going to crash, because he actually said to me, he said he's really struggling with going downhill. And I think, you know, had the same issue, you know. So I think everybody goes through that, but I certainly think, you know, if you don't like it, if you don't enjoy it, you'll struggle to really let loose, you know. It's like even Bradley, isn't it? You know, Bradley's had his issues with it, but I tell you, you know, he can do it when he wants to do it. He certainly showed it in the 2012 Tour that he can. And I think anybody who can Madison at an Olympic discipline at a medal level, technically he's fantastic, but mentally you can have a bad time. But I think you've got to start young with that sort of stuff, yeah.
I thought that showed great courage, Pino, at the Tour this year, the bad luck he had in the first week, and then that awful crash he had on a descent, and then to win the Alpe d'Huez stage in the way that he did showed great courage as well.
You focused heavily on the strength of the team. Can you just tell us, other than the riders, what is the makeup of the team on a Grand Tour, and what are the different roles that they undertake?
You mean from a staff point of
view? Yeah, how many people do you take with you?
We have on a regular about 23, 24 staff. There's Dave Brailsford on holiday most of the time. So Dave's there, you know, and to be honest with you, Dave is a real, you know, he centralises everything in a way, you know. There's Tim Kerrison, who's sort of there from a performance support point of view, so he's looking after all the equipment they're using, just leading up from the sports science side of it. There's myself, who sort of sits between everything else and the performance of the team, so I'm just making sure that nothing's getting in the way of the team. I do the recon ahead of the race, I do extra feeds, pretty much a fair role. You've got the medical staff, which is obviously Richard, one doctor on the race. We've got a physio on the race. We have five carers or soigneurs on the race. And they all have their own roles, and two of them never ever see the bike race. They're just going hotel to hotel every day, so they never actually see the racing at all. We have four mechanics. They rotate round through the Grand Tour, so they all have an experience. So there's one guy who sits in the race car, the front race car, and then the other three rotate week by week. Then we have, yeah, the media guy. So there's one guy who looks after the media.
You'd forget about him.
Yeah, media. Yeah, the chef. The chef and the chef's assistant, because we had a kitchen truck this year on the tour. We got a mechanic from Jaguar, the car supplier, so they send a mechanic full-time with us on all them races. So he just purely looks after the cars and makes sure that them cars are in good nick every day. There's the, from the VIP side as well, we've got somebody who looks after, whenever there's a guest in, we have somebody who's looking after the guests or shipping people around from that point of view.
Carson Jeppesen there most of the time as well?
On and off, yeah. So Carson sort of looks after the sponsors and does some negotiations in that side, so he's around sometimes as well. So, nutritionist is in. He's not in the whole time, but he's in quite a bit of the time. So, yeah, it's a fair amount of people, yeah.
Just a quick one for the doctor. You were saying Froome wasn't too keen on taking medicine, so if you get some kind of chest complaint or respiratory problem, what kind of techniques and treatments are there available for you to manage that?
I mean, obviously we've got the normal medical things that we can use if there's infection, you know, looking at antibiotics, but we have to balance up side effect profiles with antibiotics, and they can affect the guts in these riders. The riders have very, very sensitive gut flora, so we have to look at use of probiotics if we give antibiotics. So we always discuss and think which ones we might use. We look at what we call nebulizing. So we have certain compounds, if you like, which are amino acids that you can nebulize, which thin mucus down if they're particularly productive coughs. As I say, with Chris, we've taken some other advice about other things that we can use for him, which wouldn't really be reasonable to say, but it's all obviously legal and what have you. But it just helps him with his breathing. With the asthmatics, you look at adjusting their medications as optimal as you can. We're always maintaining their sort of health and immunity, if you like, throughout the race. Zinc. There's a lot of evidence now around the increased use of zinc with upper respiratory infections. If you take it early for 2 days, it reduces the length and the severity of colds, sore throats. So we're pretty heavy on that with them. So I think we try to look at maximising normal treatments, but being aware of side effect profiles. And then looking at their environment, that's the other thing.
Who's been the most difficult person to coach with all the talent you've had over the years?
The doc. I'll start with the best one I've coached, with Ben Swift, head and shoulders above everybody else in terms of coachable and just fantastic to work with. Difficult one to coach. I mean, they're all difficult in their own way, I think. Well, yeah, I mean, I did coach Bradley Short for a short while. That didn't last too long, but Brad's difficult, but they're all in different ways, you know. I mean, I would say Pete Kenner's difficult, Mark Cavendish is difficult, you know. The two Isle of Man lads perhaps are the most difficult of them all, you know, but not in a, just because they want it so badly, and they're very vocal, real streetwise sort of guys, you know, so they're difficult in their way. I mean, I don't work with Mark anymore on a coaching basis. I still work with him being connected to British cycling still. He's the most challenging, I think, of everybody, but then also the most rewarding, you know, because he's such a winner. So he's possibly the biggest challenge I've ever had, you know, and certainly from when I first saw him as about an 80-kilo lad who was sort of 20 kilos too heavy, really. He was a big challenge, yeah.
Doc was worried about the temperature in the room, so I opened the window. And I've got time for another couple of questions. Two more questions. Here's one.
I know that you've been over to Richmond for the checking the course out for the Worlds. Do you have a master plan for the Worlds this year?
No.
Come on, you must have got something.
I went there with Mark and we had a good look at it. And it's quite an interesting course, actually, yeah. It's not hilly, yet it's not flat. And the only reason is in the final 5K, it goes over three climbs. And again, you go around them once and most people who ride the bikes say these are nothing. But after 260K, it'll be quite challenging. And the main challenge is the last climb finishes with about 500 metres to go. So Mark is sort of... he could do it. I think if he's in form like he was at the National Road Champs, I think he could do it. But as he's already said, he doesn't want it all to be about him. Yeah, and I think we've got a couple of other guys who could have a good go at it, yeah. You know, when you think we don't have many World Tour riders now in the UK, really. I mean, we're doing pretty well, but we haven't got a load of them. But I tell you, we can go to most World Championships, I think, with a real sort of chance at winning on most terrain these days, yeah.
So final question. You're still traumatised from the last answer.
If you had a chance, any teammate who's left Team Sky, who would it be?
The one that got away.
Oh, that's a good one. For me, it would be Fletcher. I think Fletcher was a great character to have. I don't know if you know...
Juan Antonio Fletcher. Who does
the... Spanish guy.
Giro.
Does the Giro.
And the tour coverage.
On Eurosport, no? Oh, okay. He was a good guy. All right, yeah. Classics rider. Great character, really good fun to have around, and he would be somebody who was on the bus and people could be quite flat, you know, and really tired and everything else, and he'd just get up there and go, come on lads, let's get out there and race, you know. He was a proper bike racer, so yeah, I miss him around actually.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Rod and Richard, and thanks for the great questions as well, and I hope you enjoy the photographs.
This has been a special edition of the Cycling Podcast. Don't forget you can visit the Tour de Courage exhibition at the Rafa Cycle Club in Manchester. If you can't make it, the photographs can also be viewed on the World Photography Organization website. If you'd like to hear more from the 2015 Tour de France winners, become a friend of the podcast and get access to our exclusive mid-tour interview with Chris Froome and Sir Dave Brailsford, along with seven other episodes for just £5. Thanks to you for listening, to Jonathan Rowe for producing this episode, and thanks to Rafa for organizing the event.
Listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.